All right. Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Madari Music yet again. I'm Dorian Wallace. This is my co-host, DeMarisa Steele.
Hey, guys. Thank you and for being community with us again.
We are very excited because we are having our very first guest on this podcast. This is Colleen Washington from the Community Music Center of Boston. And just a little funny side note, I had actually attended an online lecture that Colleen had given on community music and, you know, was very inspired by it. But we found out that apparently you know my wife really well from back in the day. So
from back in Memphis, yeah, that's the dirty south of the Memphis, Tennessee. So yeah, I did. That's a small world. Definitely small world. And I didn't know this was your first episode, so this is an honor. Thanks for having me on as your first guest. So welcome to the land of the podcast and video cast and the like.
Yeah. So I guess to start off, tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe your work as a bassoonist and teacher, as well as community organizer, and what y'all do at the Community Music Center of Boston.
Yeah. So I grew up in Dallas, born and raised in the Dallas area. The neighborhoods I grew up in were predominantly Black and Mexican. And the schools I went to were also predominantly Black and Mexican. The long story there, they'll probably come out later in some other conversations, but got a scholarship to go to University of Texas as a chemical engineering major. That was my first major. And then I switched to music education, and then I switched to actually music study. So I don't have a degree in bassoon because after I finished up at the University of Texas, I went to the Manhattan School of Music, where I got a master's in orchestral performance. All these things kind of started to just really open my eyes up to what was in the world, coming from, in many ways, a relatively small town outside of Dallas. I spent most of my childhood in Denton, Texas, which is a little bit north of Dallas. When I finished up in school, I got my first, I accepted my first job. I'd gotten some orchestral jobs before, but I accepted my first job teaching bassoon at the University of Missouri. I was in my mid-20s. Then I got to the University of Memphis, and that's where the bulk of my performance and teaching career was, at the University of Memphis. While I was at the University of Memphis, I was trying to figure out what I wanted my tenure project to be. And so I decided to record a CD of music for bassoon by Black composers. And because I wanted to learn more about Black composers. And this is before classical musicians realized that Black people existed and Black composers existed in particular. This was really early in that. This is 2007, which is strange that that's considered early in that conversation, but it kind of was. I recorded the CD, and once I got tenure, I started thinking about what I wanted to do after being a tenured professor. I was 33 years old. So I was young and I was a tenured professor. And I was like, well, what do you do when you got a job for life? And having grown up in disinvested Black and Brown communities, I really wanted to do more work in Black and Brown and Black and Brown communities in particular. And Memphis as a city was predominantly Black city, but it was the majority of the wealth in Memphis was in white hands. And so it very much had this like apartheid like dynamic, because you had an oppressed Black majority, which is not what you have in many cities. Anyway, long story short, that led me down an entire path. My wife and I, we co-founded this organization that we're both really proud of called the Prism Ensemble. We had this big festival that was predominantly attracting white kids. And we're like, well, how do we attract more students of color? And we're like, oh, well, you go into the school system. So we started working in the school system, and that work led to an entire just like rethinking of the ways in which I engage with my artistic practice and the ways that I use my own artistic practice as a bridge into the communities and that I cared about. That connected me to an organization called the Memphis Music Initiative, which I will talk about when I talk about my own framing. It was a Black-led, Black-run, pro-Black space that I had of a like in which I'd never been in before. And it was the moment in which I realized just how much I had been code switching in order to survive in classical music. And I remember this one meeting I had where my boss, I think I was code switching in a meeting, and he just pointed at me and he was like, what are you doing? And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, oh, I get it. You don't have to do that anymore. You're with us now. And I remember like how much of my brain just like opened up. I had all of this gray matter that was available to me to learn. And so I just soaked up information because I wasn't using any of my gray matter trying to make white people happy, making white people comfortable in my presence. And I realized just how much I had going on up in the brain. And then that was the thing that really led me to where I am right now at the Community Music Center of Boston. I took a sabbatical from the University of Memphis and was doing a lot of community-based work, particularly with the Memphis Music Initiative and with the Prism Ensemble. And then when I went back, I was like, I think it's time for me to move on to the next phase of my life. And CMCB was perfect. It's one of the largest community music schools in the country. We have this huge partnership with the Boston Public Schools. We're the largest outside provider of arts education in the Boston Public Schools, working with between 3,000 and 4,000 students every week in BPS. We're also have these relationships with Health and Human Services partners through our music therapy program. And that's work that we're starting to do more of that music therapy work inside the school system. And then we have all of the other work that we're doing around the city as well. And so this place here in Boston was great because it gave me a chance to tap into all of the things that I cared about in one place, as opposed to what I was doing in Memphis, where I was like, I was doing a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, a little bit there, a little bit there. Now I'm really able to like galvanize my thinking in support of one institution.
Yeah. And I listened to your album Legacy earlier today. Mm-hmm. And two friends are on there, Gary Pelnash and Daniel Romain. Those are, really, really, really brilliant composers, but also just great human beings.
Oh, definitely. So Gary, he didn't write that piece for me. He wrote another piece for me, but that I premiered at our summer festival. Really great guy, great composer. I'm really happy for him. He's starting to get a lot more recognition right now that I think was deserved many years ago as a Black. But I think now that, again, as orchestras and ensembles and bands are starting to realize that Black composers exist, people are playing their music and they're like, oh, it's actually really good. It's like, yeah, it was good 20 years ago when they wrote it too. But then Daniel Romain, he was someone who actually met through a friend. My wife, who's from Sweden, we were going to commission a work for the birth of our son. He was, biracial. He was a marriage between the Black and Swedish cultures. And we wanted to have something to memorialize him as our first child. And so Daniel Romain wrote that piece for us, and it's based on a Swedish folk song that actually on the CD, Karina actually sings. My wife sings that song, but it's based on a Swedish folk song. It's meant to be like these loop tracks in hip hop music. And so he turns the beginning of the song into a loop track that actually goes through the music. And the piece is called Lacolian Loops because my father's name was Lacolian. My grandfather's middle name was Lacolian. Now my oldest son, Henning, his middle name is Lacolian as well. So that's kind of this loop, the looping of Lacolian in our lineage is then shown through this work. It's a really great piece.
Yeah. And DeMarisa, just so you know, Daniel Romain got into some some conflict recently in the classical music world. I forget if it was an art song piece or an opera, but it was a vocal work that he had written the text and the last sentence of the whole piece. It was "God bless America, God damn America." And he lost the commission. And so he went public with it. And, you know, it was the standard, you know, white people were happy to have him in the space, just as a filler. But the moment he actually expressed himself in an artistic way, they ripped the money away from him. And it was really, really, really disgusting. And I'm really glad he went public and did get the support from a lot of community members. But I'm going to pass it to Dee Marisa to see, what
I'm like, yeah, passing it to you. One, I just want to thank you for just answering the call over your life, right? And your leadership and your stewardship, especially as it relates to the transparency required as a person of color operating in predominantly white spaces, right? And so interesting that you would say that. So my daughter is also exploring the realm of classical music. She just started learning to play the violin this year in addition to the piano. And to get those opportunities for her, at which like I was just following just like the divine order of life. I'm like, you know, my children are very musical and I'm like, I want them to go to a music arts based school. And so to get that, I had to send her to school all the way in on Wall Street. We live in Harlem. Yeah. So in order for her to be exposed or to receive this type of access, she has to travel to school an hour and 15 minutes on the train every day. Right. Mm. And that's the reality of my community. And I want to say also just what it sounds like community that you're coming from, you know, where there's just an oppressed Black majority and resources and access are limited, in addition to the fact that we're kind of counted out of certain spaces. With that, I'm curious to know, like, how do you intentionally expose a youth of color to classical music in a way that engages them or kind of fosters the curiosity in that way?
Well, I think actually, well, one thing just about your program, somewhat you might want to get connected with the MAP program at the Juilliard School. It's in between you and Wall Street. just as something yeah. to put on you and your daughter's radar. And I'd be happy offline to connect you with some folks there because I do know people in that program. But to your question about how, it's so funny. There's all these sayings, me growing up as a Black man in Black communities, there's all these sayings that are just so simple and yet so profound. You know, in Black communities, we say, each one teach one, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Like that's like a regular saying. And we say, you can't be what you can't see. Right? You know what I mean? And so like, these are all the things that I personally grew up with as statements. And I think that is a philosophy a very simple philosophy, I think, that I bring into my own work. And so thinking about my own experience, I try to really name my experience as a Black classical musician. Mm-hmm. I try to name it as a thing. I try to name, the cultural suicide that I felt like I was required to allow inside my body, was to just, to like let go of everything that I had been in order to create space for this kind of this Western European art form to be inside my cells as well. And so that wasn't something that I was explicitly told, but the the de-amplification of my own cultural identity in that art form basically says the same thing. It's like, well, the reason your culture isn't exhibited in this art form is because it doesn't matter as much as Western European culture matters. And so that's something in my own practice I try to, in many ways, rage against, is that this kind of, you know, 18th, 19th century Western European art music is better than Motown, right? Like that, it goes, because to some people's perspective, Motown is classical music too, right? You know, and so really just trying to deconstruct the ways in which we think about these things. And actually, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. Back when I was performing a lot, I used to teach and perform at this festival in South Africa, in right outside of Cape Town in Stellenbosch.
Wow.
And there was this one year, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was at this festival as a speaker. And so as faculty, we got to meet him and we got to chat with him. And, you know, and so there's, you know, he does the narration of this piece. At the end of it, you know, there's a long line of people to go and shake Archbishop Desmond Tutu's hand. And when he gets to me, I'm like the third or fourth person, because, you know, faculty, we get to go first. Right. So I shake his hand and I was going to walk, you know, get my picture. I'm like smiling and I start to walk away and he's like, nope, stay. And I was like, OK. And so then he reaches up on my shoulder because he's sitting down and like pulls me down. So I'm kneeling, talking to Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He's like, you know what? I've heard about you. You've been coming here for a long time. Right. And I was like, yeah. And he said, you have no idea how important you are to our country. He said that there are, when I was going there, I was one of the few international Black faculty in this thing. They bring in a bunch, because I think they've seen the value in that. But I was early. I was, you know, in 2016. 2016. I was 2006. There we go. That was my first year going. And so, you know, apartheid was ended in the 90s. And so, you know, you have kids who were, some of them grew up in apartheid South Africa. They were born into apartheid South Africa. And now they were at this thing. And he said, you know, seeing our kids, seeing you on that stage, performing at the highest level with the best musicians in the world, it's things like this that are going to change our country.
Yes.
And I was just like, this was in 2013 when I met him. And there was two things. Number one, it solidified for me why I played and why I worked so hard to be good. It gave that purpose. But then for me, it also made me feel like if I could do this much with the bassoon, I wonder what else I can do with my mind. And so that was really also as important as that moment was for me as an artist. It also made me just think much more broadly. But now I'm thinking about even my role here in Boston. I'm thinking more about being able to perform with people and having young students see me perform. So it kind of normalizes this idea of Black excellence in classical music. And so that is something that I've been thinking a lot more about. I've been doing these concerts with Yo-Yo Ma recently. I mentioned some of those in this, the thing that you went to, Dorian, and I just realized just how important that has been, not for me as an artist and, you know, being able to play with this, amazing musician, this generational talent, but also when we played in this Black neighborhood, that I live in. So we played in my neighborhood at the kind of the city center. It's called Nubian Square. So we're playing, I'm a person who lives in this neighborhood and there's hundreds of people there. And it's like, it's just Blackness. And I'm there with Yo-Yo. I realized just how important it was for me to also be there. It'd be one thing for just Yo-Yo to be there, but me being there as a representative of that community, standing alongside Yo-Yo as his equal, was different than if he had just come and performed for that community. And so in my own practice, I'm trying to figure out how to scale that up. Philosophically, just how to scale that up. So he didn't come there to offer anything from a place that was lacking. He just came there to share something with a friend.
Yes.
Sharing with a friend in his friend's community. That was just like a different way philosophically of thinking about the idea of artistic practice, especially as it relates to engaging in communities.
I think that's really reflective of a lot of the work that Dorian and I have been doing. And I think that is what made our programming so successful, is that it was student-led, group-led, not student-led, because we're all keepers, right? And we create a space and we create a circle. And I think we start by setting intentions to give us a foundation. But from like day one, those intentions are like first offered to the group and left on the table for pushback. And we're able to receive that feedback and incorporate it in what we do so that everybody is owned in the space. It then becomes our space and it changes the power dynamic from like leader to student or facilitator to student to community. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we're all just giving a contribution. And I think in terms of like just an artistic modality, it allows what you said earlier, it allows the opportunity for folks to just use that gray matter that they're not always able to use, because your fears are gone. That anxiety about not being good enough, or, you know, just all of the things that a lot of us carry every day. Like there's no room for that because it's yours still. It's like your canvas still. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing. I did have a question, but before because I could just go off on a tangent. Yeah. Really quick, see if he has something he wants to say, and then I'll jump back in.
Go ahead, Dorian.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm really just thankful that you are out there, you know, leading this charge. I'm not gonna name names or anything. I was just at a festival and had some discussions with some folks there about issues with diversity of the attendees. And, you know, and just to, you know, be upfront, like when I say diversity, I'm not talking about like the neoliberal, you know, like let's hire like three people to fill a quota. And then it's like, there needs to be an actual community engagement. One of the answers I heard was, well, this is a really white town. And it was like, no, it isn't. This is a white section of town. Like, this is a white section, but you know, like, I was fucking walking around, and like, there was an entire Hispanic community that, you know, isn't here. There's an entire Black community that isn't here. There's an entire Indigenous community, like, right down the road. Like, where the fuck are you, you know, like, how the fuck are you not going to these places? Yeah. If you're concerned about diversity, and it's like, well, maybe you're not concerned with diversity, or humanity, I guess is actually probably a better way to say it.
Yeah. So, you know, this is, I talk to a lot of places, and when they're having or thinking about diversity, which, you know, is kind of a whack conversation anyway, a little bit. And the reason it is because diversity in and of itself, it tends to speak to metrics. And diversity in and of itself doesn't actually speak to power. So the power dynamics can remain the same. Hell, mm-hmm. You can have a place that's mostly Black that's still oppressive to Black people. Right.
Give a word now.
Because you have a bunch of Black people who were frontline folks and maybe managing those folks. And then you can see the point in, I love looking at org charts because I love looking at websites because you can actually see the point where the diversity initiative stopped.
Yes, come on now.
Usually it's like a level above administrative staff.
Yes.
Once you get past that point, that's when they were like, we want to have y'all facing the front but all the power and decision-making and authority happens in a room that you're not in. And so the way that the diversity initiatives tend to play themselves out is, let's get some more people of color to oppress in our white organization. Right. And to me, that's just not the way I just don't believe in that. I don't believe in supporting that. And I don't believe that that's the actual process, which is what most places do, is they kind of like, oh, we have a diversity initiative. Let's see if we can't get, you know, a black bassoonist in this 100-person orchestra. And that way we can be like, we're doing something.
Right.
You know, I get it. But to me, that is problematic. In my own institution, actually, that was something that right now, the majority of my senior staff is people of color. There are three women of color on my senior staff. Four. We just hired a new person. Four women of color. Hold on. Yeah, four. Yeah, four women of color on the senior staff here. That is intentional, because that is a perspective that really, really, really understands intersectionality in a deeply meaningful way, mm-hmm. in a way that I never will. Mm-hmm. And so it's a blind spot of mine that is mitigated by some folks on my team. Mm-hmm. And it is, again, because my job is not to have the answers. And my job is to create the room where the best answers come from. Right. And it's impossible for me to have the best answers if it's a homogenous room that doesn't have all of these various perspectives in the strategic, operational, and logistical like process, because each one of them has their own versions of oppression in them. You can't say the voice was here, but not there. You know, it's actually got to go from the strategic all the way through until you're getting to the logistical. Right. And the operational. And so, and for us, that's something that has been actually extremely intentional. It has been by design. And to me, that's why diversity initiatives, they always just ring as false and kind of white serving, because, and then I'll shut up about this because I got a whole soapbox about it, but just this last comment is, the diversity initiative, it tends to frame the people who aren't there as the problem to be solved for. How do we get more Black people to come? How do we get more Latin people to come? Like, how do we get more Asian people to be engaged with our thing? And it's like, actually, they're not the problem to be solved for. Like, your institution is the problem. Your institution either repels or expels people.
Come on.
Right. And so, like, instead of saying that, how do we get them to come? Let's start asking ourselves as an institution, what are the things that we do to repel some folks? And what are the things that we have done to put people who've actually gotten through our repellent and left? Like, what have we done to then expel people who actually got through the repellent? That's the problem to be solved for, not the fact that folks aren't coming.
Come on.
That's positioning the wrong group as the problem to be solved for. And then I think until institutions learn to do that, every diversity initiative ever created is going to be whack and unsuccessful. It's not going to move the metric at the pace of change. It's going to end up moving the metrics at the pace of privilege.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I didn't know that we were going to church. Oh my God.
Sorry.
No. You were saying?
No, I was just, that was it.
You gave us a lot. You put a lot in the cooker just now. I feel like hearing you speak was like 99% of Dorian and I's conversations for the last millions of months that we've been journeying together, especially in an institution like right now. And I think you framed it really well. Like, you know, it's either we are repelling or expelling. And I think we are repelling because we are not providing culturally relevant content, right? Yeah. I was blown away going to a concert with Dorian. His wife was performing at Lincoln Center 2 months ago, June, the end of June. where she was a part of an orchestra playing Biggie's music.
Oh, she did right? that. Yeah, I know
and
that one.
Like, yep. And I'm not saying that, you know, the only way to engage people of color is through hip hop, or but I feel like it is a starting place to relate, right? Because people won't begin to trust you until they know that you are at least attempting to understand where they come from. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And that doesn't mean assimilating. That doesn't mean like stealing the culture or trying to, like, not any of that. It's just a simple appreciation. You know, Dorian, one of the things we always laugh about is when he goes into a unit, they always assume that Dorian likes classical music. So our first question is like, what kind of music do you listen to? And they're like, oh, I listen to, or country music, right, Dorian? It's one of those two.
Country music and Kenny G. I always get this. Like, yeah, man, I love country music and I love Kenny G. And it's like, oh, cool. I'm like, you know, no beef to country or
right, yeah.
most, you know, Kenny G maybe a little, but like, you know, I have no beef like right. with it.
Right.
Right. And so like, right. And so Dorian will say like, oh, you know, that's cool. I mean, that's not like my favorite type of music, but then Dorian can also come in with some information about any other, he's like a musical library, right?
King Von. Yeah,
right. Like, King Von. You know. He'll be talking about A Boogie with the Hoodie and his experience of engaging with that. But also real information, like facts. You know, he'll introduce them to Wu-Tang. Dorian is a huge Wu-Tang fan. Mm-hmm. And so even that offers a point of engagement so that when Dorian comes in introducing to some folks Billie Holiday or things that they, Queen, things that they've probably never engaged with before, they trust him enough.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so, that's the culturally relevant piece. But also, and I jotted down when you were saying like experiencing cultural suicide to create space for yourself. Also, a lot of organizations are led by well-intentioned white people. And what they don't understand is that they still create a standard of whiteness that you have to ascribe to fit in. Mm-hmm. And that's where cultural suicide lives. That's where that's a system of oppression, right? Like, and a part of the war too. And so I think that's how we expel folks, is because some folks are just so desperate, but it just so desperate for the opportunity that they engage for as long as they can. But the mental ramifications of that outweigh the joy and really diminish the experience. And or some folks, i.e. me, are just can't conform anymore. Like, I'm just tired. And so, you know, if I can't create a space to just bring myself in there unapologetically and be validated for who I am as an artist, as a creative, and as an individual, then I just don't want it. But then I lose access, right? Or I'm cast out, right? So, Dorian, you were saying something?
Yeah, it's just two kind of responses to what you were saying. You know, the first one is, you know, the problem with the well-intentioned white liberals that often occupy these administrative spaces is the moment there is a like scent of calling out, where it's like, hey, that thing you said was kind of, you know, kind of, it gets so reactionary, goes so quick to fascism, immediately. And, you know, we've experienced it at Rikers Island. One of the things that has gotten us into a lot of trouble is the fact that, DeMarisa and I are from two different demographics that aren't supposed to be in camaraderie together. And we do 100%. And it freaks people the fuck out. Yes. But the second point, though, on the culturally relevant is, it's not even just about you know, hip hop music being relevant. Like there's also like a quote I heard once, it's real knows real. And, you know, it's like a real is going to know if you're a poser. And, you know, I always think about two very interesting demographic spaces of an artist that I love, that seeing him get ripped apart from two very different spaces, and it's Kendrick Lamar. And I'll go with this. So Kendrick, objectively, musical genius, you know, lyrical craftsman, you know, his latest album, I don't even know if it's a hip hop album. It's like, it's an art piece, like, you know.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. But we are agreed.
Yeah. So the thing that's so interesting is, you know, in the classical music world, so when Kendrick, you know, won the Pulitzer Prize, it was, oh no, classical music's been destroyed forever. Like how, like, I mean, you know, I have nothing against hip hop music, but, you know, but he shouldn't really be getting this. And, you know, if it gets pointed out that it's classism, it's like, well, he's a multimillionaire. It's like, he didn't start off as a multimillionaire, and he's the top 0.1% of brilliant in his field. And he's still not, you know, even remotely close to the 1%. But then on the flip side of it, going into a space like Rikers Island, where there's, you know, a lot of folks, underclass or lower class involved in gangs, you mentioned Kendrick and it's almost like, yeah, nah, he's all right. Like, it's like, oh, whoa. He's like the sort of like philosopher, not really, you know, not really speaking the way that like Meek Mill speaks, or, you know, and it's just, it's been an interesting kind of mental space to navigate, where it's like one space, it's like, you know, y'all are fucking racist and don't even know you're racist. And then the other side, it's like, y'all are having a classist experience. Like, you know, yeah. So it's very interesting.
Well, I think that, you know, this is a little bit of a, so I'm thinking about my sons. I have two sons, both of whom have the most eclectic taste in music that I have ever heard of. You know, I mean, they listen to all this kind of underground hip hop stuff. They listen to, you know, soundtracks to anime, you know, it's like, it's just all over the place. Like, you know, we share an account, so I'll put on their playlist and I'm like, I feel like I'm losing my damn mind a little bit, because it's just like, it's like, this is not, I don't know what's happening right now. It's like, oh, here's her. This is good. But wait, what is this? You know, it's like Ruby, what, you know? And so it's just this like super intense thing. And so I think that because of that, I think I actually think that they have gotten more musical inputs than I ever have. You know, and so like the music, like I listen to R&B, hip hop, you know, like those were the things that I, soul and all the, you know, subgroups of that. Right. And so of which there are many. Right. And so like, and so I'm like really in those buckets, and the boys are not like that. And so their relationship to music, you know, for me, I guess I probably went, you know, a foot wide and a mile deep, you know, they go a mile wide and a foot deep, you know? And so that is going to lead to a very different understanding and thinking about what is high quality music. And I think that at the end of it, when we talk about things being culturally relevant, it's not just that like a place is playing music by Black composers or playing gospel music or playing hip hop music. It's that they're making place for everything. Like even if they didn't play a piece by a Black composer this year, but based on what I see of them, I could trust that they would. Right. And so it's like, because you can look at how they show up, like you said, a real one can recognize a real one. Right. And like, and so if you're looking at a place, you're like, okay, this might be a culture that wasn't equitably represented this year. But if you look at what all that they did this year, you're like, well, I get it. You know, I imagine it's going to be a year in which that culture is going to be equitably represented, because look at the way that this institution or this ensemble, look how they show up. They show up with a bunch of things that are theirs, things that are not theirs, things that they borrowed. They're partnering and collaborating with everybody. Like these folks, they're showing up. And to me, that is what success looks like. Success doesn't look like, you know, success doesn't even look like, you know, just playing more Black composers. Like, you know, like to me, that's part of it. But we get so stuck with that. You know, we get so stuck that we don't realize that we, no matter how many of those folks that we do, we're still tokenizing them because the way that we show up and the way we think about creating the project. And so the idea is to like get ourselves out of that and be like, let's just think about all of the music in the world, right? And, you know, again, in classical music, I don't even know what the hell world music is, because I'm like, what world is classical music from? Right. Like, it's also like, even that concept is ridiculous, but that's a whole other soapbox for me.
Ethnomusicology.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, all those other ones, what like, are you saying the other ones don't have it? That's kind of that white normalizing thing, you know, but, you know, again, at the end of the day, the idea is to get to a point to where everyone is listening and showing up, being like, you know, what do you got for me this time? What new culture am I going to learn about through my relationship to you and your organization and your ensemble? Like, how am I going to become a better person by having learned about this history and community of folks that I may not be part of, right? But I can commune with them through you. Can you help me commune with these other individuals and communities that I maybe don't commune with on my own? And so to me, that is the end goal. And that's how you kind of get out of this, oh, well, we're in Appalachia, so we don't have any Black people, so we don't have to play Black composers, right? Right. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and it's like, well, I mean, I get it, you know, that's not the end goal. The end goal is true liberation. And true liberation, it comes with us all actually being united and together. And that sounds really hokey, but, you know, someone asked me, what's the end goal of all of these diversity initiatives and diversity, equity, inclusion? And what's the end goal? And I was like, bruh, liberation.
Right.
You know, that everybody that I feel is liberated in the spaces you feel. Right. And the same for you. Now, right. I'm not saying we all going to feel fully, but at least we all feel it the same.
Right.
you know, it's not the oppression is oftentimes predominantly on the backs of certain groups. Mm-hmm. See, that's what inequity is that the oppression is traditionally and typically on the backs of certain groups of people. And then every once in a while, everybody else gets a little taste. Right. I mean, to me, equity is equity of discomfort, not equity of comfort.
Yep.
Right. And been like framing it around that is really important, because we do have a very much kind of like this kumbaya, everybody's going to love each other thing once we get to equity. And that's just not true. It actually is. I think that's the end goal. But on the way there, it starts with equity of discomfort. So if there's a whole bunch of people who've been feeling some discomfort, those folks who've been feeling some comfort in that arena are going to have to probably experience some discomfort.
Right.
Then we'll all have equity of discomfort. And then we'll all collectively move towards equality and equity of comfort.
Right.
Got to get that other part first. And everybody's afraid to break any egg. You can't make that cake without them.
Come on. Can't make
there's
that
cake. There's a book called My Grandmother's Hands. We talked about it last week on the podcast. But the term he uses that I love is he talks about clean pain versus dirty pain. And part of healing trauma is you have to go through clean pain. And it's like, it is agonizing. Like, it's not like, you know, everyone, it is uncomfortable. But it's already uncomfortable, like, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, again, I definitely have been as I'm going on my own journey of understanding the dynamics of oppression. Mm. I'm really trying to lean into my understanding of privilege. And so I'm thinking about that from the perspective of myself being an able-bodied man. Mm. Right. And just like, what are all the things that I am unaware of because of my privilege of my physical ability and my privilege of being a man. Because I really, I think it would take both. And I've actually been thinking about this, you know, as someone, as a typical person, no, but as someone who works with organizations and works with institutions on how to be more equitable, which is what I do in addition to my work here. It's like, I feel like part of me, it'd be helpful for me to understand the dynamics of privilege, like how it works and how it moves, so that I can move it to the side of good. So I think about my own position as a man, when I think about my male privilege, what are the ways in which I am amplifying people who aren't cisgender males, who don't identify as being that? What are the ways in which I engage with people who don't consider themselves cisgender males? And I actually see I don't do that well all the time. Right. I can be real messy sometimes. And the question is, do I have the requisite amount of humility when I've made a mistake to accept correction? Right. And so I had to be taught. I did not get there on my own. Someone had to tell me, here is how you would accept an apology from me. You would just say, I'm sorry. You wouldn't explain to me why. You wouldn't tell me about, because now I've then got to, I've got to support you when I'm the one who was traumatized.
Yes.
Make you feel good from having traumatized me, right? You know? So if I tell you that, you know, actually you've hurt my feelings and the pronouns that I use are X, Y, and Z, then all don't say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to offend you. You have I'm such a better person than that. It just hurts me to do that to you, which, full disclosure, I've done.
Yes.
And then I was trained later by the individual who I did that to. What they told me was, hey, here's how you show up with that.
Yeah.
I heard that and have done my best in the rest of my life to change my behavior because of it. I thank them for the soft correction, and I will continue to try to do better.
Yeah.
You have my apologies. And being able to just move on and not ask a person who I've hurt to help me to heal. That's yes. My.
Oh, so yes. So hearing you speak is liberating in of itself as a woman of color. You know, Doreen and I came from a team that was predominantly white, but also I was outnumbered in terms of, what do I want to call it? The totem pole, right? Because I was the only woman of color, which kind of placed me at the bottom. And Doreen definitely had to advocate for me in many situations where I was just underrepresented or not respected simply for just being a woman of color. And so I appreciate you for just validating that this is like a truth, and being intentional about how you engage that, even in highlighting the power of women in the conversation, women of color in the conversation. So I'm just going to, I had to share that. Yeah. So I'm going to pass the story real quick.
No, thank you. Thank you for, I hear you. And I thank you for acknowledging the little bit that I might, anything that I said, and a little bit that I might've done. But, you know, full disclosure, you and all these other women, they were dope before I did anything.
Yeah. But I mean,
right.
In the fight, because we're in the war, right? This is a war. In the fight, we have stigmatized strong Black women so intensely in intimate relationships, in the work culture, and just all of those places, that the moment that you stand up and say, like, I am here, hey, don't forget about me, or, you know, this has harmed me in this way, almost instantly there's a negative connotation at it. You know what I mean? You're angry. We've all heard it. You know, you toting issues, it's transference, it's all of that, when really it's just an experience and it's real. And I think that brought Dorian and I closer, because Dorian got to be just a witness to how nasty it can get. And also how we are almost forced to assimilate even when we're being harmed. For the sake of, and like, there's so many systems of oppression that live against, or that women of color have to fight every day, especially single women of color, especially single women of color raising children, you know, economically and otherwise. And so all of those factors included, you know, oftentimes we have to be silent and we depend on allies like you, like Dorian, to advocate for us, because the message is just received in a very different way. So small and like in that we are in the, in that you are in the very beginning stages of that fight from what I'm hearing, but so crucial and so important and so liberating and so just important to a woman of color on her journey and in the fight every single day. You know, you just acknowledging that is huge to a person like me who's been in so many spaces and felt undermined and felt used and felt harmed. So I'm just thankful. Yeah.
Thank you. I will reflect on that a lot today. Thank you.
Yeah.
Would it be okay if I shared one of the microaggressions that was thrown at you? So this, you know, I don't want to, you know, speak on behalf. That's why asking for permission. But one of the most disgusting was, you know, we do creative writing. It's like part of, it's one of the things we do. And that requires notebooks. You know, the people in custody do not have access to notebooks. We bring those in. We were out of notebooks. DeMarisa, who's a former corrections officer, you know, left that world to do healing work, because, you know, just to tell you this, Licolian, she's literally like a magician when working in these spaces. It's like I've seen her tell off like literally high ranking gangsters who then come to her the next week and they're like, "Hey, I'm really sorry for being rude with you." Like, it's just like, you know, so it's just on just like, just the skill level, you know, DeMarisa is exceptional. But it's even more offensive because it's like most of the people we work with are not exceptional. And Dee is exceptional and has this, you know, huge history, has a connection to the population in a way that no one else on the team has. So anyways, we had to get more notebooks from the supply area, and Dee asked, you know, like, "Hey, where is it? I could go get them." And the response was, "Well, you really shouldn't go, because, you know, if anything turns out missing, we wouldn't want anyone." It was just like, "Wait, what the fuck are you talking about?" Like,
yeah, it was there actually verbatim, like, "I'm not saying you're a thief or anything, right? Yeah. But, you know, we just don't want anything to turn up missing. And if it does, we just don't want you to have that problem." And I was like, just happened.
Yeah, it was like, why would this individual who has already been cleared to work for the Department of Corrections, who was a former corrections officer, what would imply that she might steal something from our fucking notebook closet? But, you know, like we're laughing about it because it's so ridiculous. Yeah. But this was a real thing said by a real supervisor to a real person. And it was just, if we were to even call it out, like, what's the difference? It would have turned to immediate hostility of like, "Well, no, I'm not saying what, like, well, you know," it's just, we right. witnessed it so many times. And, and
my favorite one is that's not my intentions, right? But if I in my subconscious mind, my conscious mind have to give a disclaimer first, then you already know how it can be taken.
Right. And actually, you probably meant it.
Right. We know that.
Right. If you gave the disclaimer, you knew that what you were about, if it requires a disclaimer, you probably shouldn't say it.
Right.
I don't think, I'm not trying to be racist here. Well,
right.
You know what? Wait a minute. Not going to say that.
Right.
Because it is going to be that coming from me probably. And the same thing here, you know, and again, yeah, I think it's a, and again, I think a lot about the, Black women in particular, because even places that are trying to be more diverse and inclusive, they still can continue to be anti-Black.
Oh, yes.
Right. And that is actually quite common, especially in classical music, actually. That's where I see that a lot is in my own field. But thinking about the perspective of, of thinking about things from the perspective of Black women and actually Black queer women in particular has been really helpful for me. That framing has helped me to show up a lot differently in a lot of conversations. Mm-hmm. And Dory, you'll know this too, having such a relationship to music therapy, it's also opened my eyes up to people with various types of abilities. That has been, also just, a really helpful frame for me. And really at the end of the day, I think I did a podcast a while ago. It was called Deconstruction and Reconstruction. If I don't remember what the name of the organization was, but I didn't actually come up with the title. They took it from something that I said, and I was like, "Ooh, I like that. That was a good title," because that is the thing that I think a lot about. It's actually not trying to. People think they're trying to change something, but we're actually kind of trying to deconstruct it. And we're trying to deconstruct the things and then reconstruct them as something that is better than what it's ever been. And I think that starts with our own thinking and like deconstructing our thinking is like, why did I feel like I could show up and behave a certain way? It's like, oh, my male privilege made me feel that way. Mm. And I think about even the ways in which I can be so honest and open and transparent and be disruptive in spaces. I realize that some of the reason that I feel empowered to do that is part of my own male privilege. So when I'm doing the same thing next to a woman and a particularly woman of color, I'm like, y'all need to listen to her because this person probably had to, in order for them to get here and to be able to speak like that, that journey must have been profound. We should learn about it. And much more profound than anything I'm about to say. Like that journey must have been real because they went on my journey and another journey simultaneously in order to be sitting here.
Yep.
Right. And so I think realizing that is just so critical, and begin those with us with our various privileges, being able to walk in with the correct kind of humility and losing the fragility of our own experience. It's just so important.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you remind me of Dorian in that way. Like Dorian, that's why I love Dorian so much. That's my best friend. Dorian has always been intentional about making sure that I am seen and heard and feel seen and heard and protected in spaces. And he has used his privilege, whether it be as a male or even just as a white male, to ensure that I was given access to spaces that I probably wouldn't have otherwise been given access to and valued and validated in those spaces. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a part that's like, you're already there. I said that, like, you're already there. It's crucial, what may feel so small to you is just like, I can say in my experience of having someone to advocate for me intentionally in that way and never having that, it's been actualizing in so many other capacities. Yeah. Even in my own individual journey, Because with that journey, with kind of being the most underrepresented in the room, you tend to lose your own confidence. You tend to second guess your power and your reach in many different ways and aspects of your craft and your creativity and your gift. And so having somebody just kind of stand you upright and adjust your crown a little and say like, no, you belong here. And I'm going to make sure you get there. It just matters so much. So I'm so thankful for you both in that. I know that we are down to the hour. I don't know, Dorian, if you had another question, but I had one. And this is kind of just speaking to our audience.
Yeah.
How do you heal and preserve yourself in this fight? Like, because, you know, we're in the war and like, so I'm just for other professionals that may be listening who are kind of standing up in their communities and trying to create change. What does your self-care look like?
Well, it's several. I would start with my family. I know I have a wife and I have two sons. And I have two sons who are teenagers. So like we're interested in a lot of the same things right now. So these are like the super dope years of being a dad. Because like I went to a Corday concert with my 16-year-old son.
Nice.
And it was like the most fun I've ever. I was the oldest person there by like 15 years. And my son was probably the youngest person there by about 10 years ago because he was on a college campus. But yeah, I would say that for me, first is like leaning into my family. They bring me a lot of joy. I can honestly say that. And then also having some time to just sit by myself. I'm actually quite an extrovert. And so I love to be around people. I get a lot of energy from being around people. But every once in a while, I need to just get myself a glass of bourbon and just sit and think and just like be alone with my own thinking. Mm. And then I also have some good friends. Of course, I have a therapist. That always helps. So I'm going to see her today. that's really helpful. But also I have some good friends who allow me to just talk without solving for.
Mm.
And so they're just, you know, and so like they know that their role is not actually to be helping me to find the solution. It's just helping me to get the things out, you know, because they have less power. They have less power when they've come out of my mouth into the air than they have in my brain. In my brain, they're very powerful. And like the challenges and things, they've become a lot in my brain. And so being able to like, you know, to me, talk therapy is the best. But, you know, in talk therapy, you're working through it. Whereas I do have some friends who are like, go. It's like, yeah, and then what did they say? But then, you know, it's just like, so it's just giving me a chance to just, and I was thinking I should, what do you think about that? It's like, oh, you know, because I have a couple of friends who are like that, who just let me let the things out and release the things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, with the boys there to help me cope. That's great. And having these other, but also having these things that allow me to release, some like healthy ways of releasing the pressure. I think that's so important. And so to me, I try to find a balance between the two. So sometimes I'm like, I feel like I need to release and I'm like, no, I don't need to release. I think I need to cope. And so then it's like, boys, you want us to go watch a show. Let's go see a movie, you know, hang out with your dad for a minute. You know, and that sort of thing. So it is, but yeah, I just think about, you know, it's either coping or releasing. And I just kind of, you know, toggle back and forth between the two until one of them works.
Yeah. One thing, and then we should close out so you can get to your next commitment.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. One thing about, you know, music and psychology, which are two things we're very interested in on this podcast, but they're really innate things that a lot of human beings really do understand on an intuitive level. And there is totally understand the concepts of specialization in either of these, you know, quote unquote fields, but we have to also remember that, you know, music has been with humanity since we started speaking, you know. The way I think about it is like, you know, the moment a human being released a sound out of their mouth that was beyond linguistic communication, but some form of expression, it's like that was the first singing. Or like the moment a human being, you know, made any sort of, you know, rhythmic sound, it's like, well, that is the introduction of the drum. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar to psychology and psychological processing, is that, you know, all human beings are aware that we're going to die. Mm-hmm. All human beings are aware of their own social circumstances to some particular level. They may not have, they may have put a block up to process or to cope through it. But, you know, the real experience is that human beings are going through a lived experience, and we need to trust those lived experiences of ourselves and of our communities. That's one reason we love music, because it's a good way to actually connect on a psychological realm. Actually, with the folks we work with, it's a lot of folks who they're so turned off by talk therapy because it's oftentimes, you know, somebody who they perceive as looking down upon them, even if it's not the case. Whereas we can utilize music as a way, you know, we use Meek Mill all the time inside, because that motherfucker is, you know, his music is about being inside,
and
he's getting subtext that, you know, for us folks who have not been incarcerated, he is getting subtext that you know, I'm not even hearing. And like, you know, when you're in a room with, you know, 40 dudes who are involved in the Crips, they're all in sync together mouthing these words, like there is something where it's like, oh, there's some shit going on in this song, mm-hmm. that you know, I wouldn't have necessarily caught if I had just listened to it on my own.
I agree. And also just kind of building off of you, Dorian, creating a space where two truths can exist. And there's been many times where we have analyzed lyrics it resonated with two different realities for us. And language barrier, right? We always talk about that. Like, we definitely have been able to give cultural context in ways that others would probably never engage with through music.
One thing, you know, I talk a lot about, you mentioned two truths happening simultaneously. I talk a lot about competing truths. And so one doesn't negate the other. You know, I tell people all the time that, you know, my competing truth as a performer was, I love classical music. I always have, I always will. It is beautiful, and performing it really brought me so much joy. And I perform that music that I loved oftentimes in concert halls that were segregated during my parents' lifetime. Right. And so when I'd walk into these places, I would know that this is a place that when my parents were growing up, my parents never visited this place. Right. Because they would not have been allowed to have been in that place when they were growing up. And here I am playing this music that I love in this place that has this legacy of segregation that was damaging to my family. And, you know, and so it was both of those things. It was beautiful and powerful and special and impactful. And there were parts of it that supported the legacy, perpetuated the legacy of segregation in our country. And so it was both of those things. And then one last thing I'll say, I went to this thing with Ruben Blades, Ruben Blades, I think is how you pronounce it. but he's a Latin musician. And he was being honored at Harvard recently. And so I went to this thing and there were all these folks in there from various Latin American, you know, cultures, but they all knew who he was. And to your point, there were things that were happening in there when he started to play and he started to talk. And I even understood the Spanish, but there was something deeper in it that was happening with everyone else in the room. And I was there with my friend and his mother. And so she was like, oh, no, this is a song from the 70s. And, he borrowed from this really, really well-known, Puerto Rican song from Puerto Rico. And and I was like, oh, there's this whole other thing. And a lot of people, they feel a lot of fear in an environment like that, where there's this thing happening that they don't know. That's why we end up having these kind of monocultural presentations of art, because it's like, there's this, each group is meant to feel comfortable. But I really appreciated that I was there and he was talking to the people who were Americans and English speaking Americans. And he's talking to this other group simultaneously. And it was just like the most beautiful thing. But I was looking in the front when they started to perform and these girls got up and started dancing, because that's like, that is what the music is. It's dance music. And there was people behind him who were asking them to sit down. They were like, well, we can't, we're here to see a concert. Right. And so then I started watching these dynamics play themselves out, where there was one group that was like all Latin folks who were totally up dancing. And then this group that was more mixed. And then there were people who were not of that culture who were trying to get these kids to sit down. And the kids, who were probably teenagers, they sat down. So they didn't get to engage with their culture because of the power dynamics that were in that section. And I just like never, something that's always going to sit with me as a real thing that happened, to this idea of, this other thing that happens inside a culture that we can't always understand. Like real inclusion is just making sure that there's the space for it. And so to your point, Dorian, about hearing this, hearing Meek Mill and everybody's like, there's something happening there. It would have been weird if you were like, all right, everybody, let's not do this here. Let's get some management on this space. Let's get some management on what's happening here culturally, because I don't understand. Right. And you were like, there's something happening here. I'm just going to leave the hell alone and see,
My goodness, there sure is a lot of swearing on this song.
That part.
But I appreciate that humility, which I think a lot of folks, a lot of people with various types of privileges have a hard time tapping into legitimate humility. And so being able to do that, I think is, even though I'm just meeting you, Dee Maurice has been talking a lot about you, and I can see, where some of that affinity comes from. And I actually direct that to you both. I feel like I was at home. So thank you both for giving me a chance to be here and to chat with you. It's been a great conversation.
Yes, yeah. Jay. Dorian's an amazing pianist and composer too. He never talks about that piece, but it's something about us creatives. So thank you.
He's an amazing fashion designer. So
thank you for being in the space with us. You are so greatly appreciated. You always have a home here, so feel free to visit us. I don't know if you want to take some time to let folks know where they can find you and just like what new works you're looking for support in, because we definitely want to encourage that too. And then I'm going to leave it to Dorian to close us out.
No, thank you both. CMCB.org. Come and check us out. See the things that we're doing. And Lacolene Washington, thank you all. Thanks, everybody, for giving us, for paying attention as much as you could while we were chopping it up today. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. And, for all of those radicals who listen to our podcast and aren't as hip to the classical music world, check out Lacolene's album, Legacy. It's on Spotify. It's on all the stuff. There's some old music, some new music. So check that out. Again, we're Madary Music. My name is Dorian Wallace, and this is Dee Maurice Steele, and we're here to talk about the intersections of music, healing, and political activism. And again, you can support us on Patreon, which is in the fucking show notes, and then follow us on the socials as we're, starting to build that up. Right now, we're only on Facebook, but we're getting more. So again, thank you.